Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. We hope you find this church to be a place of freedom in expressing and experiencing your spirituality. I'm Reverend Christy Anderson, and I'm co-leading today's worship service with Becky Klein. We are grateful to have as our guest musician today, Jesse Young.
Today's chalice lighting honors our years with Reverend Melissa Carville Zimmer, who sparked so many souls, and honors our hope for a new settled minister who will do the same. At times, our light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. In a world filled with noisy chatter, we lose track of the value of having a voice. In a world full of sound and fury, speaking up can feel futile. In a world of bombastic and threatening rhetoric, voicing one's truth can be and feel risky. In a world of constantly competing messages, having your voice heard can be difficult. In this world, we often fail to recognize that we do have a voice. Not everyone has a voice, and not everyone who has a voice speaks up. But as Malala Yousafzai said, when the whole world is silent, even one voice becomes powerful. Too often our voices are silenced by fear from both internal and external sources. Wise words remind us of the potential transformation that comes from having a voice. In life, finding a voice is speaking and living the truth. Each of you has a distinctive voice, and when you find it, your story will be told. John Grisham. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Martin Luther King, Jr. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Proverbs 30, verse 8. It took me quite a long time to develop a voice, and now that I have it, I'm not going to be silent. Madeleine Albright. And speaking about Charlottesville, LeBron James said, I want to speak on it right now. I'm somebody that has a voice of command. And the only way for us to get better as a society and for us to get better as people is love. Come, let us worship as we explore, measure, and honor our opportunities to have a voice.
Let us enter into a time of reverence with a prayer that was adapted from one written by Reverend Linda Hart of the Tahoma UU Congregation. This week, with the public displays of hate, bigotry, and anti-Semitism, sadness is weighing heavy upon our hearts, and in response, I call upon the spirit of life and love. We come together today, our hearts broken, aching, weeping. We risk our hearts in love for this beautiful and harsh world. Let love flow in and out of our broken hearts, love that is stronger than hate. Love that is stronger than death. Love that can empower us in every moment to choose, to act, to answer the call. And if we are weary this moment, may we rest where there is sweetness and abundance and be restored and renewed. Let us remember that these are also times of possibility and promise, when we can lean into the struggle and create the world anew. We are called to act, to journey toward a new vision of what is essential and true and best. Let us respond with love, love beyond beliefs, beyond fear, beyond our small selves, to make the world we dream and pray for a world achieved. May it be so. Amen.
I spent most of my life in search of a voice, in search of my voice. I've stood here as a worship associate and later had supportive listeners compliment me on being a natural-born speaker. I'm anything but. What I have relearned here is that I do have a voice. And recently, I've been working on the Voices Project, the Ministerial Search Committee's efforts to hear from you about the identity, challenges, and strengths of this community, and what you wish for in a new minister. And I listen to so many of your voices in interviews and focus groups, but I got to tell you, some of your voices were really hard to hear. The first time occurred when individuals identified the Worship Associates program as a particular strength of our congregation, and this happened routinely. And knowing that I was going to be standing here today, what stopped me in my tracks and was really threatening to hear was when people used words like inspiring to talk about the Worship Associates. So, no pressure up here this morning. I could just sit down now. Oh, wait, I'm co-leading, so I'm not a Worship Associate this morning. At a worship arts team meeting, Reverend Melissa once asked us to talk about what we found valuable about being a worship associate, and mine was really easy. I said that having lived a life, both personally and sometimes professionally, in which I was voiceless, if not invisible, being a worship associate gave me a place where I could have a voice, and that was no small thing. My deep struggle to have a voice started early in life. I grew up in a home where children should be seen but not heard was an understatement. My voice had little to no value, and it was often punished. Asking a question, or for reasons or explanations, indicated something worse than lack of respect for authority. It was labeled talking back, but with no uncertainty about the consequences. And as I grew older and took some risk, suggesting an alternative view or daring to argue was even worse. As I lost my voice at home, I found it at school, and I thrived there until sixth grade. I had what I now believe was a mentally ill teacher who was enacting some inane and destructive experiment. He told us that we all thought we were smart, and that we all thought we were going to college, but that we weren't, and none of us would. This was pretty scary. My volatile dad, from the time I can remember, told his children we were going to college. Mr. O'Connor rewarded students with A's who had struggled academically in previous years, and those who had shown academically in fifth grade under a very tough teacher now received grades that included D's and E's. I thought my parents were going to kill me. They did go to the next PTA meeting, but they did not speak up. A friend's mother, who was a teacher, did speak up for the class, and things got a little better, but were far from good. And I lost my voice in school, too. About that same time, I was sexually molested by the son of my parents' best friends. I told my mother. I don't know what, if anything, my parents did, because nothing appeared to change. I concluded that they blamed me. I learned not only did I not have a voice that mattered, I could not count on others with more power to speak up for me. I developed debilitating anxiety around nearly every social situation, especially those that made me the center of attention. And I was not simply afraid of public speaking. Everybody's afraid of public speaking. I struggled to ask questions, to seek directions, to make phone calls to strangers for any reason, to raise my hand in class even when I knew I had the right answer. Much of this social anxiety persisted through college and into graduate school and beyond. My ongoing recovery is a much longer story with many chapters, and its roots are found in 4-H experiences, wise and devoted county extension personnel, in a graduate professor who believed in me when I had given up on life itself, and the mystery of a gifted therapist. It is written in a teaching career focused on communication, of all things, including on empathic listening, and in a research career that also functioned, ironically, to facilitate the voices of marginalized populations. including people with HIV/AIDS. And later, residents of a small northwest Montana town that experienced what the EPA called the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. Their community-wide exposure to a very toxic form of asbestos at the hands of a knowing corporation caused hundreds of deaths. Many more are sick. People continue to be diagnosed. But the emerging social toxicity exacerbated those health consequences. People with asbestos-related disease were stigmatized and ostracized in ways that were similar to those early in the AIDS epidemic. Mental health issues there exceed those occurring in natural disasters. Helping this community have a voice also helped me to have a voice. As part of the Search Committee's Voices Project, I've had the privilege of hearing your careful and care-filled voices about our beloved community. But again, I sometimes had a hard time hearing what was being said. At the Laurel Lakes focus group, my introductory remarks included matters about confidentiality, and Bill Eldridge interrupted me to assure me that I could quote him by name on anything he said. So here goes. As we were wrapping up, Bill said, "It's all up to you." I wasn't sure I heard him right. "What?" He repeated, "It's all up to you." And I said, what's all up to me? And he said, "The future of the church, it's all in your hands." Oh. Now, I told you I was in search of a voice, but not one quite that big. And I said so. And some clarification followed. The translation was, "It's all in the hands of the search committee." Whew, at least it wasn't all up to me. What a relief. But then, on the way home, I did the math and realized that he was still saying that 11% of the responsibility for the future of this church was in my hands. This person who is often still searching for a voice. But here's the truth, and I will speak it. The future of our church is in all of our hands. It is in your hands. It is in your voices. Not just today, but every day. Today, you have a special opportunity to have a voice where you can speak for your hoped-for future for this community. And your voice matters. All of your voices matter. In Fessenden Hall, after the service, you will find that we prepared a survey for you in your name. And now I'm searching for your voice. In some contexts, I still struggle to have a voice. But I have to tell you, this makes me immensely grateful to you for the opportunities you have given me to have a voice, and moreover, to be heard. May we all speak, may we all be visible, and may we all have a voice as we keep the future of our beloved community in all of our hands, today and every day. May it be so.
Our voices, individually and collectively, are powerful. Becky's story illustrates how giving voice to your truths reinforces self-worth, enables participation in the wider world, and can lead to justice for the voiceless. We acknowledge that life is fragile, that we are mortal, and that opportunities to raise our voices are limited. Yet too often we hold our words of truth in a tight grasp. Why can't we release them and make a difference? I suspect that it's due to fear of rejection, reprimand, being ignored, becoming vulnerable, being judged, arousing conflict, being victimized by contempt, or even abuse. Fear is a powerful deterrent. I reflected a lot this week about last weekend's rally in Charlottesville. I was struck by a blog written by a United Church of Christ minister, Kelly Gallagher, whose courage impressed me as she stood face to face with white nationalists. She reports, We had been trained the day before how to stand in the face of violence, how to protect our body and the bodies of others from violence, how to hold the line. We were encouraged to record our statement of why we came and share it with a loved one in case the worst happened. Reverend Gallagher and other counter-protesters didn't assemble to engage in a duel of hateful words, but rather to give voice to love. Despite valid fears, the Charlottesville counter-protesters knowingly placed themselves in an uncomfortable and even dangerous situation to project their alternative message of brotherhood. Speaking truth to power is daunting. I call on us to remember that Black Americans have historically sacrificed personal safety in order to raise their voices when seeking very basic rights, voting, decent education, or simply the ability to choose any seat on the bus. Last weekend in Charlottesville, the Interfaith Messengers of Love were confronted by racist men with clubs, shields, and helmets. Civil rights activists of the past also faced men armed with clubs, helmets, and guns. In many instances, they were the very men who were paid to protect them, men wearing badges as agents of a government body that sanctioned abusive tactics against people of color. I greatly admire the activists from the past and those presently who are standing up for justice. No matter whether one's voice is marginalized by family, community, or the wider society, it takes courage to express one's truth. I've experienced firsthand the discomfort and fear of expressing my voice. My courage was tested repeatedly during my 28-year employment at the Portage Metropolitan Housing Authority, an agency charged with representing the interests of vulnerable, powerless, and voiceless citizens. As these individuals were typically viewed unfavorably by the public, I was often engulfed in highly publicized, controversial housing activities, especially during my last 19 years while serving as executive director. My most controversial undertaking was the construction of a 36-unit public housing development in 1997. After a long search, we identified and purchased a building site that was perfect. The Ravenna Township property was located on the bus route along a commercial strip with just a few modest single-family homes, a TV repair shop, and a towing company. The property was designated for rental housing under the township zoning code. The residents were not as delighted as we were. The neighboring homeowners and business owners strenuously objected to the project and quickly mounted a highly visible protest. It was well organized, as almost all the folks living along the strip, much to my surprise, were related to one another. Nasty words of protest blanketed the road on massive handmade signs in violation of township signage regulations, which the officials failed to enforce. The towing company became a headquarters for people throughout the county who, although not impacted by the project, were nonetheless encouraged to stop and sign protest petitions. Public meetings were a nightmare. Objectors shouted, taunted, and disrupted when either I or the architect spoke. Only one of my board members attended in support. The others owned businesses in Ravenna that had been threatened with boycott, so they had to work quietly behind the scenes. I received harassing phone calls at home in the middle of the night, and even some threats. My board paid sheriff deputies to serve as my bodyguards when I was going to and from public meeting halls to my car. I felt paralyzed by overwhelming anxiety. Despite my stress, mental exhaustion, and sense of isolation, I doggedly pursued my goal, as I was passionate about the importance of decent, affordable housing for families struggling to become financially self-sufficient. Our agency's mission was to represent the interests of the silent voices lacking economic and political power. I was committed to defending these individuals who were being unjustly portrayed as drug users, criminals, deadbeats ripping off the system. I did have some empathy for the working class neighbors who resented what they perceived as government handouts when they had worked so hard for so little gain. Putting myself in their shoes, I tried to convey facts to counteract the stereotyping and myths and highlight similarities between them and the future residents. I learned that facts are hollow when emotions reign. The detractors weren't swayed by my logical arguments. Yet my small, unwavering voice did make a difference. I learned this important lesson. Although my voice was disregarded by opponents, it inspired others to speak up. Some high-profile supporters stepped into the spotlight. Sister Jordan, a well-known, outspoken Catholic nun, attended every public meeting and spoke the harsh truth with words that I didn't dare verbalize in public. Commissioner Chuck Kuiper and Ravenna Township Trustee Frank Hairston bravely voiced public support. I name these two courageous elected officials as they subsequently lost their bids for re-election, with Frank's defeat a direct result of his support for our housing development. The Township Zoning Board's strategy was to deny a permit despite knowing that we didn't need a single variance, in the hope that by stalling the project long enough, our funding would be revoked by HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. During the 13 months it took for a favorable ruling on our lawsuit at the local and appeals court, HUD respected our tenacity and extended our deadlines again and again. Ultimately, we prevailed, although the number of apartments built was reduced by 4 due to legal costs. The completed housing campus consists of attractive low-rise buildings tucked into a wooded area off the main road. Social service agencies stepped forward and offered extensive on-site support services. The new renters thrived, and the neighborhood residents quieted as their fears dissolved. The experience was transformational. I discovered an inner strength that I had previously underestimated. Early in my career, I hung a poster in my office that pictured 2 dogs of differing sizes. The caption read, "It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog." I had embodied this truism. I waged a battle solely with my words. My voice was my weapon, my power. In Reverend Gallagher's blog I mentioned earlier, she shares a powerful observation spoken during worship at Charlottesville's United Church of Christ by ministerial candidate Brittany Kane Conley. She writes, "Brittany said that she felt called to put her body in a place where it could absorb some of the hate and violence so that black and brown bodies didn't have to, because they've been absorbing the violence for so long." That is what Jesus did. He absorbed the hate and evil of the world and gave back love." End quote. Looking back, I now realize that was also part of my role, to absorb the hate directed at the voiceless, the powerless. Perhaps as people of white privilege, that's one of our roles, to show up, breathe in hate, and speak out love. I'm not exceptional in any way. We all have the capacity to project our love unto a world in need of reconciliation. As Black feminist, civil rights activist, and poet Audre Lorde reassures us, the speaking will get easier and easier, and you will find you've fallen in love with your own vision, which you may never have realized you had. And you will lose some friends and realize you don't miss them. And new ones will find you and cherish you. And at last you'll know with surpassing certainty that only one thing is more frightening than speaking your truth, and that is not speaking. Millions of people, past and present, have raised their voices to speak truth. We too can summon the courage to raise our voice. Lucy Pierce, author of Burning Woman, reminds us, breaking our silence is powerful, whether it comes as a whisper or a squeak at first. Allow the sense of opening. Though it may start softly, we build in confidence and skills. We do not need to wait for others to make space for us. We do not need to read from other scripts. We do not need to look at one another's authority because we have our own down in our core. It's our turn, our time, our turn to be on the stage. Our voices are needed. Ordinary people can accomplish extraordinary deeds by courageously lifting up our voice. What do you plan to do with your precious and mighty voice?
Many people do not have a place to be safe, a place where they can have a voice. Historically, our congregation has supported the important work of providing safe sanctuary, and this year has committed to a year of anti-racism work. Our special offering today benefits Kent Citizens for Democracy, an organization working toward making Kent a sanctuary city and thereby enabling the safety and voices of others. If you are a guest, we invite you to take a bookmark from the basket as our gift to you. The offering will be gratefully received.
In your order of service is an affirmation, and I'm going to invite you to stand, but a little bit differently this time. We're going to ask the folks sitting on this side to face the people across the aisle and the people on this side to do likewise, face the people across from you, and we're going to go back and forth. I will start with this side, and we will read the first line in regular type print, and then Becky and this side of the room will read the italicized, and we'll continue like that until the end where it says "all together," and we will read that sentence all together. I can defy those who would silence me because I have a voice.
I can overcome those who discredit, mock, or ignore me because I have a voice.
I can speak up when someone is pressuring me to go along, smile falsely, and appear to agree because I have a voice.
I can share my needs, feelings, truth, and dreams because I have a voice.
I can shine light on injustice and speak up for the oppressed because I have a voice.
I can inspire others to take action because I have a voice.
When I am afraid, uncomfortable, intimidated, or weary, may I remember that I possess power because I have a voice. I close with this reminder from author Neil Gaiman. The one thing that you have that nobody else has is you. Your voice, your mind, your story, your vision. So write and draw and build and play and dance and sing and live as only you can. Go in peace.